NASA's Juno spacecraft passed within about 350 miles of the Earth's surface this week before slingshotting off into space on a historic exploration of Jupiter. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we'll hear from the president of the University of Iowa Amateur Radio Club about why they waved to Juno electronically as Juno whizzed by the Earth. We'll also talk with Donald Kirchner, University of Iowa research scientist and lead investigator for one of Juno's nine scientific instruments. Before that, Iowa's Secretary of State on voter fraud and a nearly $500,000 grant to strengthen suicide prevention efforts in Iowa. Those and other news items in our news buzz after this news update from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a news buzz edition of our program today. We'll touch on a half dozen or so news items that we didn't touch on earlier this week that I think you'll find interesting. For instance, we'll talk with the president of the University of Iowa Amateur Radio Club a little bit later about why they sent out a signal to this mission, this spacecraft, Juno, as it whizzed by the Earth on Wednesday. We'll also talk to Donald Kirchner, University of Iowa research scientist, also lead investigator for one of Juno's nine scientific instruments. Find out why it's so important to find out more about Jupiter. That's where this spacecraft Juno is heading. A number of other things before we get to that. Let's start off with voter fraud. Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz is a strong proponent of voter ID laws. He's also made identifying and prosecuting voter fraud a centerpiece of his administration. And now he's claiming victory in a couple of cases this week. A Dallas County man has pleaded guilty and been fined over $1,000 for third-degree election misconduct as a serious misdemeanor. And then we heard just today that a Melbourne man was sentenced to in Marshall County for voter fraud case earlier this week. 5-year suspended sentence, 2 years probation. And joining us now by phone is Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz. Welcome back to our program. Thank you for joining us.
It's good to talk to you, Ben.
Tell us what happened in these cases. What were these men doing?
Well, in Dallas County, we had a gentleman who was a non-citizen and a felon. He had committed a felony out of state. I don't know all the details about his felony, but he was both a non-citizen and a felon. He had registered to vote and voted in the 2010 general election. And, you know, because of the DCI investigations that are obviously ongoing, this is one of the individuals that was brought to justice.
Mm-hmm. The other case, do you have any information on that?
Yeah, the other case was a felon who had registered and voted in the 2012 general election. Again, just pled guilty this week on the 8th. So for the non-citizen case, the one we were talking about earlier in Dallas County, this individual was from Bosnia, was Bosnian, and then the Marshall County case is a felon.
Mm-hmm. So how many cases total does this bring us to as far as people who have been convicted or pled guilty to voter fraud?
We have five people so far who have pled guilty. You know, we've run into several issues, I would say, over the last year of conducting these investigations, one of which I wasn't granted access to the federal database so that we could actually clear some of the non-citizen cases until recently. And because of the court case that's going on, we still have not used the database because we're being sued by the ACLU. And we've talked about that before on your program.
Mm-hmm.
The other incident was our original investigator actually got deployed to Iraq in the middle of the investigation. So that we had to get another investigator assigned that caused some complications. But basically what's been going on is DCI has been working with ICE to vet the list of individuals that we had forwarded to them. And these are the individuals that we had come to the DOT and asked for a driver's license. You know, they were here legally going to school or work, having a visa. And then also we're on our voter registration rolls. And so I knew that it was very possible that these individuals became citizens sometime between then, between the time of going to DOT and the time of voting, but not all of them.
Right.
And so we didn't forward those names to county auditors like Florida did to have them removed, but we did forward them to DC DCI to at least start going through and trying to narrow that list down, and that's what DCI has been working on.
Secretary Schultz, I wonder, a lot of resources, a lot of effort, a lot of man hours being put into this. As you mentioned, the DCI, an investigator with the DCI has been working on behalf of your office for more than a year, specifically investigating instances of voter fraud. You named five cases here. Has it really been worth it, to five cases of all this effort? I realize every person that votes fraudulently is important, but we're talking about five cases, and it seems like your office is going to a great deal of effort, time, resources to bag very few people.
Well, you know, I understand your point. The investigations aren't over. And as I said, DCI spent a lot of time working on trying to vet the list down, because obviously DCI doesn't want to go knocking on people's doors when they're citizens and haven't done anything wrong. And so I think you're going to see over the next several months that it's going to be definitely more than five individuals. I think it really boils down to this, and that is, are we going to tolerate people to cheat? I guess I'd ask any Iowan if they want to volunteer to have their vote canceled, because that's essentially what happens when somebody cheats.
Well,
the vote.
Right. And the ACLU would say, though, is it worth five cases to possibly, as they're claiming in the lawsuit you mentioned, disenfranchise and intimidate eligible voters?
Well, we're not intimidating anybody. I mean, we're not sending out letters or anything to people who we don't have some sort of evidence about. And we haven't sent any letters yet because of the lawsuit that's going on, obviously. But, you know, I mean, it really boils down to this. I mean, it's my job to make sure we have fair and honest elections. And before we did these investigations, everybody said there was no voter fraud. You know, there's no such thing. It's never happened. It never occurs. Well, it's really just the fact that nobody's ever tried to do anything about it. And so, you know, I'm working hard to make sure that we have fair and honest elections. There may be a disagreement on whether, you would agree with the resources being put into it. But the question is this, really, what are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to just let people cheat? Or are we supposed to protect people's vote? And from my perspective, I think we need to protect the vote. I think having voter integrity is extremely important to the process and protecting people's freedom.
Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz, thank you for joining us briefly.
Ben, thanks for letting me come on. It's always good talking to you.
Okay, take care. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, News Buzz edition. We're quickly going through a number of news items from this week. Iowa has received $440,000 grant to strengthen suicide prevention efforts. And this week, the Iowa Department of Public Health announced that the three-year federal grant will be used for several programs. We'll find out a little bit more about this by talking to Michelle Tilotta of the Iowa Department of Public Health. Michelle, are you there?
I am here. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you for joining us. Tell us, first of all, how common is suicide in Iowa?
suicide in Iowa is let me grab my facts here a little bit. Suicides are the second leading cause of death among Iowans that are ages 15 to 24. Mm-hmm. That is reported to us by our Vital Statistics Department. And suicide really is the fourth leading cause of death among younger Iowans ages 5 to 14.
Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about the most common factors that lead to suicide in Iowa and, I assume, across the nation?
There's really quite a bit of factors that why teenagers commit suicide. You know, we don't really know for sure, but when youth die by suicide, they take the answers with them, unfortunately. But teens who attempt suicide and survive really tell us that they wanted to die to really end the emotional and psychological pain. And they oftentimes experience a number of stressors and feel like they just don't have the strength or desire to continue living. And we also believe that the majority of youth who die by suicide have a mental disorder like depression, which is often many times undiagnosed, untreated, or both.
Tell us a little bit, before we have to say goodbye, Michelle, about the suicide prevention efforts already in place and what this nearly $500,000 grant adds to that.
Well, we're really excited. And the $500,000, almost $500,000, is actually per year. So it's close to $1.3 million over the life of the grant. And what we will do is implement some evidence-based screening and assessments for suicide risk at our substance abuse treatment programs that are funded by the department, so that we can really give the skill set to the providers there to screen and assess and get some immediate referrals to community resources, as well as we will be working with the Department of Education and local area education agencies to teach education staff how to screen and assess for suicide risk, and then how to make community referrals in a very timely and efficient manner. And then the other piece of it is we will be spending some time on doing some prevention activities and some media campaigns so that we can really inform the public and parents, caregivers, educators about what do you do, how do you recognize warning signs of suicide, what do you do when a teenager specifically is talking about committing suicide or is showing some of the warning signs so that they're prepared to really expedite the process and get these teenagers the help they need.
Okay. Michelle Talata of the Iowa Department of Health, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Let's touch on this before we take a break. Iowa is the only state in the nation that allows cameras to be permanently installed along interstate roads or highways managed by the state. And this week, the Iowa Transportation officials took on the issue of automated traffic cameras with a proposed new set of rules designed to give them control over whether speed and red light cameras are placed on state highways and interstates that they oversee. Now, the rules must go through a public hearing process and other steps before they're finalized. The first public hearing about the proposal was held this week, Tuesday, at the Capitol. Joining us now to explain a little bit about this process, Steve Gent, director of the Iowa Department of Transportation's Office of Traffic Safety. Hi, Steve.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Tell us about these rules the DOT is proposing.
We really created the rules to create a process for basically procedures and responsibilities for when a city or county wants to put automated traffic enforcement cameras on the primary highway system. And they do relate to both fixed and mobile systems.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the concerns that these rules are addressing.
Well, I guess over the years, the department has had a lot of comments and criticism from people who've gotten tickets, and so we take a little bit of that into account. But really, the bigger issue is we know these automated cameras can be effective. The research shows that, so it's been documented. However, they really need to be used when the crash data and when all the other information shows that they can be effective, because the real concern is whether or not it's a financial money issue for the cities.
Right. That's been we've had conversations about this topic on several shows over the course of the last few years here on River to River. That's what it is, a criticism. People will call up and say, this is, if it's Cedar Rapids or wherever it is, this is just money-making. And undoubtedly, they are money-makers, aren't they?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, the amount of money is huge.
Millions of dollars per year for Cedar Rapids, for instance.
Yeah, we just got some information from Cedar Rapids in the last fiscal year, July through June. They made over $4 million on their speed cameras, and here I can check. About $300,000 on their red light running cameras. So, very significant, and Sioux City actually has raised more funds than Cedar Rapids, for sure.
Now, merely because a community, a city, makes money on these traffic cameras doesn't mean that it can't be both a moneymaker and effective as a safety device, right? So what do studies show us about when speed and red light cameras are effective?
Well, there's a lot more research on red light running cameras, and they generally do reduce right angle crashes, which are the more severe type of crashes. However, they typically increase rear end crashes. So there's been more studies done on those. The speed cameras, there really has not been a lot of research out there because they really haven't been around that long. And they are very effective in reducing speeds. However, does that really relate to crashes? And that's really what the critical issue is here. I mean, if it's safety, it's all about crashes, not about speed.
Well, why wouldn't speed relate to have a relationship with crashes?
Well, it certainly does, but it's not a one-to-one ratio or anything. In fact, there's a lot of misinformation about speed. We as engineers, and you can take that for what it's worth, but the safest speed is when everybody drives the same speed. Just imagine yourself driving on Interstate 80, and if everybody's driving the same speed, nobody's, you know, veering around, waiting. There's no big queues of cars or people trying to get around cars. Everybody's just comfortable driving the same speed, and that is clearly the safest speed. So.
Okay, Steve Gent, you hear our music. We have to go take a break here. Thank you for telling us about it. Remind us, how can people weigh in on this now and during this process?
Absolutely. We want public input as much as we can get on our website. We got information on how you can send us emails and your comments. We are going to have a public information meeting on October the 30th in Ankeny. Welcome anyone to get your comments. That's what we want. We want this to be an open and transparent process.
Thank you, Steve Gent.
All right.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thank you for joining us over the noon hour on Iowa Public Radio. News Buzz edition of our program today. In just a few minutes, we'll be going to the stars. Well, not quite to the stars, I guess. We're going out to Jupiter with this mission, Juno. We'll be talking with Donald Kirchner, University of Iowa research engineer and lead investigator for one of Juno's 9 scientific instruments, and find out why it's so valuable to find out more about Juno with this probe. But before that, a member of the University of Northern Iowa homecoming court is making history. Stephen Sanchez, who identifies as a transgender female, is the first such student at the University of Northern Iowa to be nominated for homecoming queen. Joining us now, Stephen Sanchez, University of Iowa Northern Iowa student, candidate for homecoming queen. Hi, Stephen.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. Now, some of our listeners may be unclear about what it means to be transgender female. In your case, explain.
Actually, transgender female is a little bit, it's not exactly what I identify as. Transgender is an umbrella term that includes many different identities. And right now, my gender identity is in sort of a transitional phase. But for me, it just means that I'm neither completely a man or a woman. You know, I'm not completely macho and rugged, but I'm not completely 100% feminine. I'm somewhere in the middle. So that's what that means to me.
Does that mean you want to change your sex?
Me personally, I don't have a desire to do that at the present time, but like I said, my gender identity is in a state of transition, and I might decide to do that one day, but right now I'm perfectly comfortable expressing both sides of myself in the body that I'm in now.
So when people refer to you as a male or a female, is either one correct, or do you prefer one?
I prefer male when describing my body, because I am a male-bodied person. But as far as gender goes, I'm, you know, like I said, genderqueer is a good word because that's neither one, neither man or woman, but physically I am male. So.
Okay. So tell us, Stephen, why do you want to be homecoming queen at the University of Northern Iowa?
There are several things that went into my decision to run. On a personal level, it just meant to be a part of a great tradition that I never got the chance to be a part of in high school because I didn't have a traditional high school experience. And it also meant an opportunity to raise visibility of LGBT people on campus. And so those are the two main motivators that made me want to do this.
Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit about sending a message here, too. Tell us more about the message you want to send.
Definitely. I think the biggest part of my message that I want to send is that, first of all, that UNI is a great place to be whoever you are and that you'll find a place on campus where you're accepted 100%. And I want to send that message out there to any students who might be struggling, especially considering today is National Coming Out Day, so I think it's the perfect time to send that sort of message. And also, I just, again, want to raise visibility and show that LGBT people are people just like everyone else, and they want to be a part of all the same traditions that, you know, the general population does want to take part in for the most part. So,
how have people reacted to your quest to be homecoming queen?
The response has been overwhelmingly positive. I've had so many people who have come to me and told me that I restored their Panther pride or that I made them proud to be a Panther, and so that feels so amazing. And I have heard some whispers that there's been one or two people who've been kind of confused or, you know, didn't necessarily agree with it, but directly to me, there's been no negative reactions, and that's been amazing.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, what does it mean that you've received so much attention for this? For instance, have you how much media has gotten in touch with you?
Just so far, I've spoken to the Cedar Falls Courier. They did a story on me, and also KWWL, and then the school paper here. And then also I have an interview with the Des Moines Register coming up, and it's a little bit overwhelming and exciting, but I think it just shows that LGBT issues, especially transgender issues now, are becoming more and more of something that's talked about in the public sphere when it hasn't always been that way. So I think that's definitely a good thing. But also on a smaller scale, I feel it represents here at UNI that the community is being more accepting and more open to talking about different identities and different groups of people and including everyone. So,
as you mentioned, you're a member of UNI Proud. It's founded on the sort of promoting inclusiveness, accepting, making an accepting campus environment for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, mm-hmm. intersex, other individuals. How would you describe the climate for this group on campus at UNI in Cedar Falls?
The climate for UNI Proud as a group is incredibly open and accepting. You know, anyone is welcome to come to our meetings as long as you're supportive of the LGBT community. And you'll definitely find there's been so many people who have made such beautiful connections through the work that UNI Proud has done. I have friends who've met, you know, boyfriends and girlfriends through the group that they wouldn't have met otherwise. So definitely it's an open and accepting place where you can meet so many amazing people. And through the work that we've done, we've helped to promote LGBT issues on campus. So that's helped on a broader scale across campus to raise awareness and acceptance of people of various identities all across campus and not just within Proud.
What would you put at the top of the list for challenges that UNI Proud wants to address?
One of the major things that we've been working on is getting an LGBT center. And we actually, we're in the process of getting one right now. It should be opening within the year or at the very least, I think by next semester or next year. So that's been exciting. And something that we're working on now that we have that is gender-neutral housing and bathrooms for transgender students or students who don't feel like they'd be comfortable in an all-male dorm or an all-female dorm. So that's the next step, I think, to take. And that's another reason why I think this is so important, because I think trans issues are the next important thing to push forward in the LGBT activist group. So I think this just reflects that broader trend. So,
what does a living area that like that look like? Does it look any different than other living areas on campus?
It would be exactly the same. It would just be open to anyone who wants to be on a gender-neutral floor where you know, they don't have to be lumped in with a group that they don't necessarily identify with. It wouldn't really be any different. Like as far as restrooms go, we do have some single-stall restrooms across campus, and that's pretty much what a gender-neutral restroom could be. It could be just one stall with a door that locks and for anyone to use. So it's really not different. It's just making it known that that's a space where anyone is welcome.
Stephen, I understand tonight the homecoming court will announce the winner, the homecoming queen.
Yes.
You will be there?
Yes, definitely.
Can you tell us what you'll be wearing?
I want to keep it a surprise, but I'm trying to sort of mix the glamour that comes along with being a queen with the school spirit and, you know, the spirit of homecoming, which is, you know, sporty and athletic and just school spirit. So I'm excited.
Uh-huh. How many other candidates are competing?
There's 5 candidates for queen and 5 for king, so 10 total.
Okay. Stephen Sanchez, University of Northern Iowa student, candidate for homecoming queen. We wish you the best of luck tonight.
Thank you so much.
And it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a News Buzz edition of our program. As promised, we're taking you outside of our earthly bounds here into, well, at least to the other part of another part of the solar system. NASA's Juno spacecraft, did you know this, passed within 350 miles of the Earth's surface this week. Not that we would notice that. It's slingshotting off into space on a historic exploration of Jupiter. The Juno Waves instrument will be the 8th University of Iowa instrument to make Jupiter. It's on board. Previous Iowa instruments were carried aboard Pioneers 10 and 11, Voyagers 1 and 2, Galileo. Also included a couple of UI instruments. Cassini, you've heard of these if you're into space exploration. Cassini currently orbiting around Saturn, I believe. The Waves instrument was built at the University of Iowa by a group of a dozen scientists, engineers, and technicians, and led by research engineer Donald Kirchner. He joins us in our studio in Iowa City. Donald Kirchner, welcome.
Hello. Glad to be here.
So tell us what happened on Wednesday. Why was if we think about things, we say, well, Juno was launched back in August of 2011. How come we see it so close to the Earth again?
Well, the problem is we do not have rockets large enough to boost the payloads that we would like to send to Jupiter. So to save energy and save money, we do a maneuver called an Earth Gravity Assist, in which we send the spacecraft out. It goes out a little past Mars, comes back, comes in around behind the planet, and then essentially steals some energy from Earth. And it's about like getting almost another extra launch. We pick up that much energy.
So it really is, when we say slingshot, very much like that a David and Goliath thing, where it's being slung around the bodies that are in our solar system to pick up their energy.
Right. That's sort of an analogy. It's basically a gravity interaction between the two bodies that adds motion or changes the angular momentum vector of it. But I don't want to get too complicated. It's actually mathematically a little complicated.
Okay. Donald Kirchner, how did you mark this near pass of the Juno spacecraft? Did you do anything special here on Earth?
Well, our instrument on the Juno spacecraft is a sensitive radio detector that we've built to look at radio waves at Jupiter. And that detector is able to pick up signals that we commonly use here on Earth for ham radio transmissions. So we organized an activity with thousands of amateurs all over the world to try to transmit it to see if we can pick it up with our instrument.
Okay, and that's where Tony Rogers, also in our studio, comes in, president of the University of Iowa Amateur Radio Club. Hi, Tony.
Hi, thank you.
You were among a number of people in your club, I assume, in a room. You were doing what as the spacecraft Juno was hurtling past the Earth 25 miles a second?
A little more than an hour before closest approach, we had about half a dozen members of the University of Iowa Amateur Radio Club, as well as members of the science team here at the University of Iowa, up on the roof of Van Allen Hall, and we had amateur radio equipment and were transmitting a Morse code message to the waves instrument on board the Juno spacecraft.
So that was involved, what, a keyboard or what? Morse code is one key, maybe.
Yeah. No, we had a transmitter and an amplifier and an antenna and all that stuff. But really, in the end, it all came down to 100-year-old telegraph key that we had sitting out there. And we invited members of the public, as well as all the members of the Amateur Radio Club, to sit down and take a turn actually helping tap out the message to Juno.
And what was the message?
Hi. H-I.
H-I. It was as simple as that.
Just as simple as that.
Didn't ask Juno how it's doing.
No. Generally, they have telemetry that'll really tell everybody how the spacecraft's doing. But we wanted to make sure we sent something back.
Okay, Donald Kirchner, did Juno hear that? Did it receive it?
Well, we're still collecting the data. You might have heard in the news that the spacecraft went into a safing event halfway through the encounter. So,
what kind of event is that?
Basically, think about it. If you're printing a long document and the printer jams halfway through the document and just sits there waiting for you to come and clear it.
That doesn't sound good.
Well, it's...
My printer, it doesn't sound good at all.
It's certainly not a nice thing to happen. It happens regularly in spacecraft. I mean, they're designed to work autonomously, and if they see something they don't think is right, put themselves into a safe mode, and that's what occurred.
Was it the fact that the spacecraft was bombarded by all these messages from Earth that did
it? No, we're certain that had nothing to do
with it. That had nothing to do with it. So Juno's computers are doing what right now? It's trying to sort this out?
As soon as an event like this happens, then the engineering team goes into a mode where they try to sort out what happened. The spacecraft reverts back to a fairly simple operating state and, reduces the telemetry rate and just make sure that it's in a mode where they can get the most information back and nothing bad can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then they start sending the data back more slowly than we would have normally liked.
Okay. And you say you're not extremely worried about this. This happens
right. I mean,
regularly.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is the first time it's happened to Juno, but it's happened to Cassini maybe 5 or 6 times. And, you know, it's a normal design for the spacecraft to be able to handle these types of events. And basically what the engineering crew is doing is going out and clearing the jam in the printer and letting it keep sending us data back.
If you just joined us, Donald Kirchner, that's his voice, the University of Iowa research engineer and lead investigator for one of Juno's 9 scientific instruments. So tell us a little bit about the bigger picture of Juno's mission. Is this the last time Juno will have a close flyby of the Earth, or do we need some more slingshotting power to get Juno to Jupiter?
Well, first I'll clarify, I'm the lead engineer, not the lead investigator.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
William Kurth is the lead investigator, but he's out at in Denver watching the data as it comes in. So, no, this is the only gravity assist maneuver for this spacecraft. Galileo, for instance, did 3 gravity encounters, 1 with Venus and 2 with Earth, to get it out to Jupiter. But for Juno, this is the only one we need.
Okay, so talk about what Juno hopes to find out when it reaches Jupiter. How close will it get to Jupiter? Will it go into orbit?
It goes into orbit. It's a polar orbit around Jupiter. The difference between Juno and the previous missions, this is the first solar-powered mission to Jupiter. So we're operating on solar panels, very large solar panels. I think they're about 40 square meters of solar array. And the orbit we go into is a polar orbit, and it never goes into eclipse, so it never gets shade on the solar arrays. And it's a very elliptical orbit, takes about 11 days, and we fly in very close to the planet, and we'll be flying directly through the what they call auroral acceleration region, where a lot of the waves that we're looking for are generated. So our instrument is actually designed not to be terribly sensitive, because the region that we're flying through is extremely loud in radio waves, and the science that we're interested in seeing is exactly how loud they are when we're flying right through them.
Mm-hmm. And when will this take place about?
We get to Jupiter, I think, July 4th, 2016.
Okay, so it's got a little bit of time out there in space, and in between, the spacecraft is just traveling through space on a more or less a direct line trajectory.
Right. There's a transfer orbit that it's going through to get there, and just before, the few months before we get to Jupiter, we will turn on. I mean, we'll be collecting some data in the meanwhile, but. And the solar wind for this particular instrument is not terribly interesting. We'd certainly like to get as much data as we can, but how much they'll allow us to get is a question. But a few months before we get to Jupiter, we'll turn on and start doing calibrations, because Jupiter will be a very loud point radio source, and we can calibrate our antennas and tell how everything is working and get ready to go into orbit.
Tony Rogers, president of the University of Iowa Amateur Radio Club, you had this signal that you sent to Juno as it flew by the Earth, relatively close, just 350 miles from the Earth's surface earlier this week. Will you be having any other messages sent to Juno? Was that it?
I'm afraid that's it. Mm-hmm. It was going to be a near thing for us to be able to send messages in the amateur bands to Juno in the first place, just because of the way the ionosphere works and the frequencies that the WAVES instrument can detect. As it stands, it's not only would it be difficult for us to be able to get those frequencies out of the Earth's atmosphere or out of the Earth's ionosphere, but it's also just too far away. It takes a great deal of power to be able to transmit a message that kind of distance. You know, NASA and JPL and the science team, they have very specialized transmitters and receivers to be able to ensure they can have that kind of communication. And I'm afraid as radio amateurs, we just don't have that scale of equipment.
So you typed out a Morse code message to Juno, hi. Mm-hmm. Well, what was the biggest kick for you and the other members of the amateur radio club in doing that? What did you talk about there?
For radio amateurs, we can talk to each other across town or across the state, across the country, even across the world fairly easily. I mean, that's something we do every day. We have contests to do it. And talking to things that are in orbit, like the International Space Station, or there are some amateur radio satellites that we talk to on a fairly regular basis. the most exciting thing, at least for me, and I know for a lot of the other members of the club, was getting to talk to something that isn't in orbit and is going to be on the other side of the solar system in a couple of years. And, you know, just having a chance to touch that and be a part of that was a unique experience.
Mm-hmm. You talked about getting in touch with other amateur radio operators in the world. These type of radio waves are strange things, too. You can, what, bounce them around, get them to the other part of the world? How does that work?
We send radio waves out, and instead of sending them straight up to try and bounce off the ionosphere, we actually send them at a fairly shallow angle. And then they go quite a distance before they bounce off the bottom of the ionosphere. And depending on the frequency, that determines where in the ionosphere they bounce off of. But bouncing off, then they come back down again and land on some other part of the Earth. And they can bounce multiple times between the surface of the Earth and the bottom of the ionosphere. And so the different number of bounces will get you to different locations and let you talk to people all the way around the world. There's a joke that if the ionosphere is working well enough for you, you can talk to yourself the long way around.
Back to you, Donald Kirchner, University of Iowa research engineer. Tell us more about this mission or perhaps the other missions. Are you involved with some of the other missions that the University of Iowa has instruments on?
Well, I was started as a student very shortly before we were selected for the Voyager mission. So I was able to work on the Voyager missions, and I've worked on Galileo and Cassini and now Juno. And as of now, I'm working on a mission called JUICE, which is a European space agency mission. So that'll be my sixth instrument to Jupiter.
What is JUICE doing? Got about a minute left to just find out.
JUICE is our the RIME instrument, which is the instrument I'm working on, is a ice-penetrating radar similar to the one that we sent to Mars. And we're going to try to look at the structure of the icy moons of Jupiter and determine geologically as much information as they can.
Mm-hmm. Have events, political events in Washington affected you, worried you and your colleagues at all when we're talking about federal money for grants and research at all?
I have a couple of contracts right now that are being held up because they require an email from JPL or from NASA, the NASA office, to approve them, to send them to me. So, yes, it's affected me directly.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us for this portion of the program. Donald Kirchner, University of Iowa research engineer and lead engineer for one of Juno's nine scientific instruments. And also thank you, Tony Rogers, president of the University of Iowa Amateur Radio Club. Thanks for coming in as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Monday on this program, the 2013 World Food Prize is honoring three scientists whose individual discoveries led to the creation of genetically modified crops. By 2012, GMOs were grown on more than 170 million hectares around the globe by over 17 million farmers, but they remain controversial. Monday on the program, we'll talk with the laureates about their scientific work and its critics. And River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.